Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the weekly podcast that, despite being an audio product staffed by libertarians, manages to dress more professionally than Senator John Fetterman. I am Matt Welch, joined by Fetterman's old sparring partner, Nick Gillespie, as well as the also dressed, I think, Peter Suderman and Catherine Mengu Ward. Hello, colleagues.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday. It is true that I'm dressed. I wouldn't say I'm dressed well.
We are all still evidently in the afterglow of an editorial retreat last week. So if we're all like unaccountably either nice to each other or more snippy than ever, this is just because we inaugurated the Reason DC HQ, the big staff meeting last week, and it was very, very nice. So thank you for everybody who supports Reason to make it all possible. I should say that while we are engaging in our trust exercises and ritual paddling and tattooing the son of the President of the United States of America on Thursday was indicted.
Doing the same thing.
Was doing the same thing. Again, sliding down the slide. Was indicted in federal court on 3 counts in connection with being a crackhead with a gun. 2 counts with a maximum prison sentence of 10 years a pop allege that Hunter Biden lied on a federally mandated application to buy a revolver in 2018 when he claimed that he was not an unlawful user of any controlled substance. The 3rd charge, punishable by up to 5 years, said that he possessed a firearm while using a narcotic. It wasn't supposed to be this way for our dear poor Hunter. As recently as late July, Biden and the U.S. attorney in Delaware had agreed on a combination plea bargain and jail diversion agreement in which he copped to 2 misdemeanor tax evasion charges in return for non-prosecution of the gun charges if he successfully completed a 2-year program of living like a functional human. That deal was scotched by a federal judge who balked at its highly unusual blanket, "We will not prosecute you for the future crimes that we find," among other weird irregularities. We talked about the collapse of that agreement on our July 31st episode, our Milton Friedman birthday episode of this very podcast. So, Catherine, I want to get into the meat and potatoes of the charges under question. These were brought by Special Counsel David Weiss, who may yet charge Biden on the tax evasion and possible corrupt activities based on him being an international man of business. So on this one, we've got guns and drugs with a probable side order of taxes, maybe a little bit later. So is Hunter Biden going to be Reason Magazine's Man of the Year? And if not, what do we think of the federal statutes and penalties under question?
We don't think much of those federal statutes and penalties, honestly. I mean, the core of this, which every single time I relearn about it, I struggle to believe, is when on a form that the government asked him to fill out, he did not confess to other crimes. And it's like, we shouldn't build a system that requires people to confess to other crimes in order to, like, follow the letter of the law. This is similar to, you know, there are, like, technically tax rates for illegal drug transactions. So that's always, it's like, well, you know, you can go to jail for selling the drugs, but also you didn't pay your taxes. Like, of course I didn't pay my taxes. I'm doing something illegal. Jesus Christ. And so I think, you know, this idea that, like, are you a regular user of illegal drugs on a form, like, You gotta be something really special.
I just want everyone to know that I plan to snip out Catherine's, "Of course I didn't pay my taxes, I'm doing something illegal," and submit that to relevant authorities.
This is my mother-in-law's nightmare. For many, many years, she paid for the tax preparation for my household in what I always thought was a nice gesture. And later I realized that it was because she was scared we weren't going to pay our taxes because we're so libertarian. Anyway, so, yes,
it's, I hope you didn't deduct her the money she spent.
No, that would be illegal, Nick, and I don't break the law. You can clip that one too. Okay, so the incredible, amazing, spectacular Jacob Sullum has written much, 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 much about this, the horrific interaction between our war on drugs and our gun control laws. This is a sort of maximum intersection of that stupid, even before you get into the stupid of the politics. And it just simply shouldn't be the case that one right is contingent on the other. And yet we have created a situation in which that is sort of, question mark, true.
Peter, let's build on that nexus. Is there something inevitable about it being the guns and drugs place, being the place that kind of feeds raw meat into the criminal justice system, given that, to vastly overgeneralize, the left hates guns, the right hates drugs, and cops and prosecutors love really easy to prosecute crimes?
It's almost as if gun crimes and drug crimes are the, like, the carbs and protein of the criminal justice's diet or something. No, where am I going?
I'm
here?
Not sure.
I don't know.
Did that work?
I understood you're going to an all fat diet,
which I suspect would probably be healthier than anything else. But
the whiskey and chicken wings, and by that I'm referring to my own personal diet. Yeah, I mean, it's not in any way surprising that guns and drugs ended up being the issue here. And just something that we should add to this, since Catherine talked about how these laws are bad, is that it is quite possible that the law that Hunter is being prosecuted under is unconstitutional based on the decision, the big gun decision from the Supreme Court last year by Clarence Thomas, which more or less said, of course you can have reasonable gun restrictions, blah, blah, blah. Like, we're not ruling any out necessarily, but they have to be grounded in the text and history of the Constitution and America's legal system and culture. And what that basically means is that stuff that was done in the 20th century, but not beforehand, like prohibit people from buying guns because they may use drugs at some point, is probably not legal under that standard, probably not constitutional under that standard. And so we may end up in a situation in which Joe Biden, if he wants to argue that his son shouldn't be prosecuted here and should get off, he is going to have to accept a standard for gun regulation and for what constitutes constitutional gun regulation that he has criticized in the past, a quite conservative standard laid out by Clarence Thomas. And so there's some real kind of constitutional and political irony here, in addition to just the inevitable, well, this is what happens when you build a system that just does a bunch of stuff with drugs and guns, and that's your whiskey and chicken wings diet.
Nick, you were the editor of Reason when we had a Peter Bagg cover on the right to own your own bazooka, I do believe. Is there any legitimate federal government interest in asking gun buyers whether they are users of illegal drugs or any other kind of like personal questions like that? And or if you were to break character and suddenly go buy a gun, would you lie about your own filthy drug habits?
I would almost certainly be high on about 10 different things, Matt. That's the only way I see myself actually buying a gun. The short answer is, regardless of these laws, Hunter Biden shouldn't have lied on a gun license application, nor should any of us, you know, willfully lie on applications, whether it's for the private sector or the public sector or anything like that. Whether or not he should be prosecuted the way he is, whether or not these laws should cancel out other rights, you know, that's a separate matter. But, you know, Hunter constantly finds himself in these situations, not because, you know, all of us are committing three felonies a day. And that's why, you know, actually we have to cut this podcast short because all of us have multiple hearings to go to because of all the felonies that we've gotten in trouble. Hunter Biden is absolutely, I mean, I don't even know, he's beyond a John Fogerty song. He's not just a senator's son, he's a president's son, and he can't fucking keep out of prison. You know, that doesn't say anything about the situation of law and legality in America. I am reminded more about this because ultimately I care more about drug policy than I care about gun policy. And Joe Biden has been one of the very, very worst people. He is an architect and a general and a foot soldier and everything else in the war on drugs. You know, Hunter Biden has been treated incredibly leniently in the course of all of his drug problems. I actually think that that's the model that should be extended fully to virtually everybody who has substance abuse problems, and then things come out of that. If you hurt people, if you destroy property, if you do things like that while fucked up, you need to pay. But you know, the fact of substance abuse itself needs to be treated in a radically different way. And I was hopeful in a way that, because all of this stuff came up in a big way during the presidential campaign before 2020, I thought Joe Biden was actually getting there. You know, in that as Nixon went to China, Joe Biden could be the person who really just absolutely fundamentally changes the way we discuss substance issues as well as legalization. But I don't think that's going to happen. And that's an ongoing tragedy.
I think what you hear in all of these answers is just that there are two clear ways to think about this. The first is that the laws that Hunter is accused of breaking are bad and maybe unconstitutional, and that is highly relevant to considering this case. And the second is he broke the law. He broke the law flagrantly. He does not seem to be somebody who has a high level of concern for the law. And the law is the law, and we have the rule of law, and we care about it, and no one is above the law. And that also is important here. And there's a real similarity in that dual understanding here between how we are thinking about Hunter and to some of the questions surrounding the prosecutions of former President Donald Trump.
There's also, I remind all of you, like bootlickers there on this podcast, that we have a moral duty to disobey unjust laws, like by sniffing all the crack on the carpet, waving around a gun.
Yeah. I often think of Hunter Biden as the Henry David Thoreau of, you know, of revenge porn.
I guess because Matt exists, we now have to say, like, it is, if you are in the throes of like active addiction, like in a kind of end stage scenario, don't buy a gun. Like, I guess just like as a personal advice from me to you, our dear listeners, like if you're really as blasted as Hunter Biden seems to have been at that moment in his life, like please don't buy a gun. That's not going to go great. And then best case scenario is that you end up throwing it in a garbage can.
Or having your gal pal throw it in a garbage can.
Side of the road like he did. Yeah.
I will say, though, on that point is that Hunter Biden didn't appear to be in a great spot in his life. But as far as I'm aware, and correct me if I'm wrong here, as far as I'm aware, there is no evidence that he was high or using actively while purchasing the gun, or that he was high or using while carrying the gun. And that this is... as far at least in public, like the bedroom,
he's being accused of is not driving around while fucked up, waving a gun, or shooting at people. It's
there's some dubious photo shoots.
About,
that's what we have, so.
And this is part of the objection to these laws. Just forget the constitutional objections. This is part of the problem we have with these laws: is that they don't criminalize what I think all of us would say is at minimum obviously stupid and just bad, like bad behavior, which would be getting really high and running around in public with a gun and maybe firing it, or like that's stupid. That's bad. We shouldn't, like, people shouldn't do that. But that's not what is at issue here, and that's not what these laws criminalize.
Catherine, House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, the so-called Bakersfield Comet, announced last week the launching of an impeachment inquiry. I don't know why it's funny. Impeachment inquiry, which is an investigation to see whether President Joseph Robinette Biden II did impeachable stuff, such as enriching himself via the international business activities of his no good son. None of this seems to have to do with guns and drugs, by the way, at least yet. The chances of this inquiry leading to an actual impeachment and then resulting in a Senate trial to convict Biden of high crimes and misdemeanors is roughly equivalent to the chances of me lasting even 1 year with a new laptop. So thumbs up or thumbs down for impeachment inquiry in the Congress, Catherine.
So there is a gun involved, which is the metaphorical smoking gun that no one can stop talking about.
Wow.
You're welcome. Yeah. And
I've got a smoking gun for cocktails.
No, jeez, Louise.
Bad.
Right. So there's this kind of like today's semantic debate is like, is there no smoking gun that that Joe Biden was sort of actively involved in the favors promised by Hunter on his behalf or that he did favors on his behalf? Or is there is there no evidence? And that's the subtle distinction. We actually got ourselves tangled in some of those ropes on this podcast a few weeks ago. And I think that in a way it is clarifying to have this distinction between like, is there evidence and is there a smoking gun? Because there's some evidence. There's a bunch of circumstantial evidence. There's a bunch of claims made by different people of varying degrees of reliability. But there is no, you know, tape of Joe Biden saying, I will do X for Y. There is no email. We don't have the smoking gun. So I think that debate is interesting and relevant. I am officially on record with like impeach everyone everywhere always. I associate myself with the Gene Healy position, which Reason has published on this. Like we should probably impeach more presidents. Certainly more presidents than have been impeached have done impeachable things. This one doesn't seem like the one that's going to change the course of history in an important and constitutionally relevant way. I would love for presidents to be impeached for more substantive and consequential misbehavior.
Nick, you are the impeachment skeptic on this panel. Mm-hmm. What do you?
How many impeached presidents have actually been found guilty and pushed out of office?
In fact, zero. Although yep. It led to arguably Richard Nixon's resignation in anticipation yes. of that. But so I presume that you are interested in some of these allegations. So what is the best venue in the Congress for investigating this further, do you think?
It's unlikely that it will happen in the current political climate, but as with Watergate and things like that, it's bipartisan, serious committees of congressional idiots looking into the executive branch. Because what politics is lacking more than anything or as much as anything is a sense of legitimate authority. And when you have, you know, kind of phony committees investigating certain things with preordained outcomes, either positive or negative, depending on the party in power and the person that they're, you know, going after or covering up for, you know, that would be the thing. I keep, and I'm trying to remember now, the conversation I had just sometime yesterday. It was in a haze because I was buying a gun while, you know... I had bought a piece of carpet that was supposedly from Hunter Biden, and I was cleaning it, and suddenly I became overcome with anxiety and paranoia. But
I hope your memoir is titled "Ketamine and a Machine Gun."
That would be wonderful. I can see the cover already. And but it's what we need is a Congress that actually legislates and does its job from time to time. And that's not going to happen. So I think any of these impeachment proceedings just really drive down all of the bad things or you know, they continue and light fire to all of the bad things that are happening in D.C. I would love to see an actual investigation into what's going on. And to be honest, even that seems, you know, kind of adrift at this point because everybody knows the investigations into Biden are not serious in a profound way and they're just about political advantage.
I would invite listeners to go and read the opening statements upon the formation of the Joint Select Committee to investigate stuff around Watergate. I think that's the actual name. The opening statements by both Republicans and Democrats about the need to follow facts where they may go, and just the level of professed, at least, seriousness. And I think the work that the Watergate Committee did was pretty serious. It's just like the past is a different planet. It's impossible to imagine today's political climate. John Fetterman padding up in his shorts and giving great sort of speeches like that. Peter, there's been a lot of journalistic wind exhaled about how there's no evidence or an absence of evidence here. J.D. Tuccilli wrote a good piece for us, I think this morning or over the weekend, about this. You have sworn congressional testimony that Hunter put his dad on a speakerphone like 20 times while doing international business. Like, hey, say hello there, Dad. That's bad, right? That's some smoke worth looking into.
That's absolutely bad, and it is worth looking into. I'm not sure it actually constitutes impeachable behavior on the part of Joe Biden, who is the person who's actually president. So Hunter Biden is shady as all hell. He is dubious. He is unethical. He appears to have absolutely no regard for the law or decency or norms. He is not a good character. But the best that anybody has done to tie Joe Biden to Hunter's dubious activities is to say that Joe Biden was in the room with some people that Hunter was maybe shaking down, fleecing, doing dirty deals with, whatever it was that you want to say that he was doing, and that probably Joe Biden was aware that Hunter Biden was using his dad's name. So is that an impeachable offense? That's not something that Joe Biden himself was doing. It doesn't look good. It's not like, oh man, I just my heart is filled with joy and warmth at the prospect of Joe Biden, who knew that his son was trading on his dad's famous and powerful name. But it's just not the same thing as the president or the vice president or a senator actually doing that stuff himself while in office or shortly thereafter. And that is a real difference here. And I think that, you know, Nick said that these investigations are entirely political. I think they're very heavily political, and it would be silly to say otherwise. But I do think there's some real substance here, which is that if you can tie Joe Biden directly to he approved, signed off, or intentionally participated in these shady schemes, then maybe that's impeachable. But we're not quite there yet. And that's why I support further investigations. But I don't think that this has risen to the level of impeaching Joe Biden. And I think a lot of this is an attempt by Republicans to create an equivalence between Biden and Trump, when in fact the equivalence is between Hunter Biden and Trump, the much better equivalence, I should say. Again, it's not that Joe Biden didn't do anything that you think, oh man, that's a little dicey.
But this is the problem that they're trying to tie, you know, so whatever, you know, Trump did, it's no different than what Biden did. But Biden should be impeached and removed from office, blah, blah, blah. It's endless. You know, what is frustrating, and we obviously can't expect any better from the Republicans. They're already, you know, the fact that they can tie their shoes and get dressed every day is, you know, they're maxing out their intellectual capacity and their political seriousness. We have a government that is spending so much money, that is trying to control more and more aspects of everyday life from the right and the left. We came out of Russiagate, which was a big bunch of malarkey, to use a Bidenism. And when is the last time that anybody has seriously talked about anything having to do with actual policy that's going to change the, you know, the forward trajectory?
So I will actually say that the impeachment effort is a little bit awkwardly tied up with a bunch of concerns about spending in Congress right now. And there is at least a little bit of a debate about which thing is more important to pursue. Spending reductions, which are maybe kind of bullshit and maybe kind of silly and maybe won't even happen, but are at least like a real substantive policy issue, or whether the focus should be on pushing forward with impeachment, basically as a, you know, in order to set the political stage for Trump's next run.
Let's consider that a segue. We've got the United Nations General Assembly meeting in New York City this week, which is super great for fans of traffic jams. The gathering will also be notable for the presence and speech of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who will also be visiting Washington this week to meet with the president and lawmakers on Capitol Hill to try to loosen America's wallet for more military aid to the invaded country. So, Peter, let's just follow up. We've got another federal budget deadline, because why not? That it's supposed to be coming up at the end of the month. We'll see if they stick to that. Biden is asking for another $24 billion or thereabouts in military and humanitarian aid. We've already spent $100 billion plus so far. I think this would be the first official vote of the new Republican Congress on aid to Ukraine. So that's a little bit of a gut check for them. They are balky, or at least portions of the GOP caucus are balky. They want a standalone vote on it. We're already well into the presidential campaign season right now. What is your sense about Zelensky's third visit and the latest rattling of the cup, and where those budget negotiations are and how this is playing out politically?
Zelensky is here to ask for money, to ask for more money, because he cannot continue to wage his war. It's certainly not the level that he has been waging it without American funding, without American weaponry. And $20 to $25 billion, which is the kind of budget range that we're looking at here, is on the one hand a huge amount of money. On the other hand, not that much money in the scheme of the federal budget. And on the other hand, would make a big difference for Zelensky and for Ukraine. And this is going to be an interesting political issue to watch as the election plays out, because there are a bunch of Republicans who are very skeptical of spending this money. I would say that I am skeptical of further funding here, certainly at this level, because what it amounts to is the United States waging proxy war against Russia. And as utterly and totally and without caveat just as the Ukraine cause is here, they were invaded, they have every right to fight back. Even saying that they were totally right, I do not like the idea of the United States effectively being the bank and the weapons provider, the armorer for a war against Russia. And I think that it puts us in a more dangerous position with regards to the potential for just a much broader outbreak of conflict between two nuclear armed powers.
European countries in aggregate have still spent a bit more than the U.S. so far. That's still a lot of money and a lot of our money.
So even if Europe is contributing 70% of the budget here, any organization that has a budget knows that if you lose your single largest funder, even if that funder is not contributing 51% of your budget, that's a big deal. That makes it very hard to continue doing what you have been doing.
Speaking of losing, Nick, the United States Air Force yesterday lost a plane.
Yeah, if you guys that's saw okay. This. That's okay. You know, it's that's like only summer. One. Yeah.
It's a near.
We have so many.
Who hasn't lost something like that? I mean, we've all lost cars at the mall.
Have we?
Permanently? Like,
sure.
The Joint Chiefs dropped their keys, but oops, it was an F.
And they're outside the circle where the clicker is going to, you know, make a sound.
You just reminded me, Nick, that
I love the image of. Sorry, go
just, ahead. This is important, Catherine, that I think in the year 1988, I lost a $200 car that I had named Luke with a Q. Go on, Catherine.
I literally was just going to share the mental image of the Air Force walking around going boop, 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 boop. Looking for
are we in a doom loop of Pentagon spending, Nick?
No, that's a great question. Yeah.
And if so, how might we pull ourselves out of the spin?
You know, by electing Governor Gary Johnson in 2012 or 2016.
Both.
I think at this point we are effectively reduced to time travel as a solution to most of our political problems, Matt.
Shout out, throwback to the Time Bandits, what you've been consuming from last week.
Oh, right? Absolutely, yeah. Matt. Yeah. I think that the Ukraine aid issue, I like the idea of it being put up to a standalone vote. Interestingly, I think the Republicans will buckle so hard on that.
Yep.
But I think more things should be standalone votes. I mean, more and more things, because people should be able to know what their politicians are voting for. I think, you know, the large import outside of Ukraine and Russia and Europe of the Ukraine war is that it really demonstrates the diminishing returns to violence that the authors of a book called The Sovereign Individual wrote about in the late 90s. And, you know, part of that is because the U.S. helped, as well as the European countries you're talking about and things like that. But, you know, the idea that the U.S. should constantly be funding a country with which it has absolutely zero actual defense agreements or anything like that is insane. And the United States needs to figure out a way to bring the Ukraine-Russian war to a close that is livable. It's not going to be perfect for anybody, but to the extent that we're involved, we're perpetuating something that is not going to end well for anybody.
Catherine, what's your sense of what the U.S. should be doing right now as Zelensky comes in asking for more money?
I mean, not having our foreign policy decision making hinged on our absolutely insane budgetary decision making. Like, that, this is ultimately like the thing that really stands out to me. The idea that this man is in the middle of conducting a whole ass war, like a real war. And he's like, well, you know, they're doing the budget on September 30th in the U.S., so I guess I'll go there then for that. Like, none of that makes sense. Like, if we want to do this, if we want to support Ukraine either financially or with, you know, selling them munitions, that's fine. That should be a totally separate conversation. It should be completely unconnected from our broader budget conversation, which is already wildly overburdened with 17 other considerations. I do think it is a legitimate matter to reevaluate after partisan control shifts, right? Like, this is, in theory, the kind of consequence an election could have. And so I think it is appropriate to, like, re-ask the question now. I think there's some, you know, some of the discourse around this that I've seen sort of implies that somehow, like, well, once we gave, you know, Zelensky money once, we're somehow morally bound to, like, give him as much money as he wants forever and ever. And that's not the case. We're allowed to change our minds as a people, and elections are the way that we do that.
The 1974 Budget Control and Impoundment Act, which I occasionally mention on
this podcast.
I've heard
of it, yeah.
Yeah, so it created the Congressional Budget Office and the modern budget process, and I don't think the Zelensky war aid speech was part of the calendar.
Yet here we are.
All right, we're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, Catherine, today's Reason Roundup sure looks different than before. What has changed, and why should our listeners be excited about it?
We have done a one-for-one Liz-to-Liz swap with the Roundup. So Elizabeth Nolan Brown, senior editor who has been writing the Roundup for many, many years, had a baby. And so she is on maternity leave, and we are experimenting with a bold new Roundup, still edited and written by a Reason staffer named Liz, but this one is Liz Wolf. And you will see it's a little different in your inbox this morning. It's a little breezier. It's a little more on top of the main news of the day. And it's linkier. So hopefully it will serve the purpose that the Roundup has always kind of served of. Here's the stuff you need to know today that you, a fan of Free Minds and Free Markets, or maybe like a hate reader of Free Minds and Free Markets, but probably a fan, want to know about with a little take and some fun stuff to read.
Thank you, Catherine. All right. A reminder to email your brief queries to roundtable@reason.com. This delightful entry comes from Kyle Butler, who writes, "Okay, Roundtable friends. About 30 years ago, I won a DARE essay contest at school. Not sure that I remember what it was about, but I'm sure I captured all of the tropes around drugs and policing. Anyway, I won a Series EE savings bond. It has finally matured, and it's time to cash it in. Looks like I get about $80 American. What would the Reason Roundtable suggest I do with the earnings? Buy some pot? Thanks, Kyle. Nick, you're the drug addict among us. What do you think that Kyle should do?
I have flagged this and it'll be in the show notes, but there's a great DARE shirt that is available on Etsy, which it says DARE, D-A-R-E, drugs are really expensive. And Kyle can pick up about four of them for $80. Shipping might bring it over that total. I want to explain it's a unisex shirt. Mm-hmm. So if you are interested, you know, if you insist on having shirts for men and shirts for women, this will inflame you. But I would go with the DARE drugs are really expensive shirt at Etsy for $18.95. It's from rock salt shirts, and it's got a perfect 5 out of 5 rating.
Catherine, what do you recommend?
I recommend, first of all, congratulations to this champion and defender of truth and goodness. Second, I think that they should buy PCP because for me, PCP was like the drug that like really was at the center of a lot of my DARE education. I feel like maybe it was just the moment that I was in DARE, but like it also, as far as I could tell, as far as like the uniformed police officer with their suitcase full of sample drugs conveyed to me, it gave you superpowers. Like that seemed to be the big takeaway about PCP from that era, was that you could like fly maybe or like lift an entire car and throw it at a cop. And like, I don't know, that seems pretty cool. So I suggest just a purchase of whatever amount of PCP that money will get you, which I'm happy to report. I don't know how much that is.
Also, and, that you could be shot repeatedly. Yes.
And not go down. Oh, that's right.
Keep raging.
Yes.
And also remember, kids, sometimes it's known by its street name. Matt, what was PCP
Angel
called?
Dust.
Angel Dust.
That's right.
It's
yeah.
Because, but again, I knew that because they had that briefcase with all the drugs. Did y'all have the briefcase? Yeah. Where it was like
how many
of
those cops never
names.
Yeah, how many of those cops never made it out of the school alive?
That's true. I just, fun fact, on my 12th birthday, a car with me and 10 of my friends in it was
so it was subcompact.
It was a Lincoln Mercury, was totaled by a guy driving a white van who was on PCP, and my foot was fractured. Peter, what should Kyle Butler do with his $80 matured savings bond?
He should buy a bottle of Knob Creek 12-year bourbon. It'll run him just shy of $80, including tax. It is consistently rated as one of the very best values in the world of American bourbon, with a big age statement and a huge, rich flavor profile, despite having like a relatively low proof for something that just has so much flavor. It's 50% ABV in contrast to many of the barrel proof bourbons that are out there. And it has notes of cherry and nougat, kind of tastes like Cherry Coke and a Snickers bar, but in whiskey form. Drink it neat, 1 or 2 ounces at a time, ideally while sitting around a fire pit with friends.
Kyle, the obvious answer to this question that my colleagues once again have proven to be bad libertarians on this episode, 5 subscriptions to Reason Magazine, Frenemy subscriptions, if you prefer. You could send it to your favorite DEA officer, leader, whatever. You could send it to people that you love, that you,
or DEI.
Yeah, all the D's, just, you know, DOA for everybody. Send them to Randy Weingarten, whoever, whatever. Just get it, just to the guy in the White House. Send it to him. Although he probably gets it. So yes, Reason subscriptions begin at like just under $15. Go to reason.com/subscribe. If you want to keep it in the spirit of your original purchase, if you want to pay it forward, you could also say, all right, I'm going to buy an $80 bond for a new high school essay contest for someone to explain why government provided or government paid for promotional anti-drug campaigns in schools backfire, according to all the social science research, and are stupid. So you can do that one too. Either way, freedom wins, love wins. See me at Beetlejuice later on. Okay, where are we now in this podcast? it has been a real bad stretch of polling for President Biden. Just this week, we've got a CBS News survey showing Donald Trump with a 15 percentage point lead over Biden among independents, which, as Nick Gillespie can rightly tell you, are the swing votes in American politics. And also, just fun fact, Trump has had no lead with independents ever since basically November 3rd, 2016. So this is pretty startling stuff. There have been increasing panicky calls among Democrats and journalists, although I repeat myself, for Biden to maybe think about not running for re-election. David Ignatius wrote a piece in the Washington Post, and other people are yakety-yakking about it. In the Democratic primary, it is true he is polling 50-plus percentage points ahead of the pretty kooky competition. but this is still the biggest challenge any incumbent president has faced in 30 years since Patty Buick ran up against George H.W. Bush, who then lost the general election. So Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is averaging about 12% nationally. Marianne Williamson, about 6% nationally after she got like two votes for anything last time around. Kennedy last week, not that anyone is paying attention to him the same way that they were 2 months ago. But nevertheless, this guy who's the bulk of his career has been about environmental advocacy last week released a big several point plan about how he's going to finally go after plastics. Catherine, you think that plastic bags are good for you. Which of his Twitter thread did you find most poignantly incorrect?
You know, I always look for the silver lining, Matt. You know me, I'm a positive and friendly gal. The last 2 points of his 10-point plan are fine. He wants to end subsidies for plastics producers, and he wants to do a study just to see what's up with the plastic waste. Those things seem fine. But all of the other points are varying degrees of bad and also varying degrees of vague. Like, I understand this is a Twitter thread, but I guess this is where we're doing national politics. And
there's also an op-ed in The Hill.
Oh, there's an op-ed in The Hill. So we're now, you know, we've got
so
an extra
up
200
to
words of information.
Words.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, the vaguely alluded to ambitious international treaty, like what? You know, I know there are many treaties out there. I know that there's various things under discussion. But, you know, the worst bit is the fact that this is central to his platform and would be. I mean, he, as Matt said, has a long history as a quite aggressive and authoritarian environmentalist. And plastics are, in fact, good. They help us, be healthier and safer, and they make things cheaper. And the idea that we are looking there for what is wrong in this world, to me, is deeply misguided.
Nick, as an aficionado of the gnomedesuck.com slot car hate bath, which just popped in my brain for no reason at all, what did you hate the most about RFK's idea about saving the planet?
His point number 7 is, I will ban fracking, which provides the feedstock for most of the plastics produced in the United States. And I want to point out a couple of things. One is that fracking in America really took off as a major thing during the Obama years. And the U.S. has been the largest producer of crude oil since 2018, mostly because of fracking. Fracking is actually a massive boon to the energy economy. If energy prices are going up, one of the reasons they're not going up the way that they would be otherwise is because of fracking. And also that throughout all of this, U.S. greenhouse gases are well below 2007 levels because of reductions in coal and an increase in non-hydroelectric power, along with fracking, which is better for the environment than digging up coal and burning coal and things like that. So I think, you know, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is not going to win. He may damage Biden in a way that is serious and that has real implications in the general election. But I hope that libertarians who took a long and mostly uncritical look at him, kind of take the fuller picture that somebody, you know, Kennedy, I agree with him on a lot of his policy conclusions, including things like being anti-interventionist and whatnot. But you have to look at the full picture and also the reasoning that he uses to get to his conclusions. And generally, they're not very good or thought through.
Peter, what is what point stuck in your craw?
Has anybody here seen the movie The Graduate?
Yeah.
Yes.
The most memorable single bit from that movie.
Watch it now.
Is when a guy comes up to the character played by Dustin Hoffman and just says, I want to say one word to you. Just one word. Are you listening? Plastics. There's a great future in plastics. Think about it. Will you think about it? And this is sort of weird and silly and is kind of makes a meta point about it, sort of synthetic stuff in the movie and sort of the oddness of being a college graduate in that time. But it's actually sort of turns out to be just correct.
He's not wrong.
There was a great future in plastics. Our modern world is made of them. And I don't want to actually pull out any single point because Nick pulled the fracking thing, and that's probably the most important of the points to talk about how bad it is. But this whole thread, the op-ed, this whole plan from RFK is a reminder that he is historically just dead set against maybe not all forms, but many, many forms of industrial production and making stuff that is useful. He got his start waging lawsuits against corporations for making, basically just for making chemicals and for combining those chemicals with aspects of the environment. And so one way to think about him is that he is someone who just has a long career of being against the modern capitalist world and the abundance that it affords us. He is an anti-abundance liberal. And that is something that RFK's defenders need to reckon with, is that this is his record, is he doesn't want us to have the nice things. He wants people to not make stuff and not have things that we can use and that make our lives better.
My least favorite point, or one that I'll just focus on for a second, is number 8, which is, I will limit construction and expansion of plastic production facilities. My brother in Christ, under what authority? A president was like, you know what? I'm going to limit construction. Limit it. You know, I'm not ban it. I just sort of limit it with my pen and my phone because they're making stuff I don't like.
Both of which are basically made out of plastic.
Thank you. In China. Yeah. It's just like there's no thought at all. And this is not unique at all to RFK Jr. Sadly, it's now every president does it. Every presidential candidate does it, of just sort of wish casting what's going to happen, not on day one, but on minute one of their presidency. Vast expansion and exercise of presidential power that is on its face unconstitutional, happens all the time. It is not called out as such all the time. And it should be, damn it, called out every time. Okay.
We're going to have to hire a beat reporter to cover RFK's DPPP, the Department of Plastic Production and Planning.
At any rate, let's go to our end of the podcast, what we have all been consuming in the cultural arena. Catherine, why don't you lead us off?
I went to a store to buy stuff, and I want to talk about it. So I went to Micro Center, which is a place where you can buy all the bits and pieces for a computer if you wanted to build a computer, because my almost 10-year-old son, was ready to become the kind of guy that I suspect many of our listeners are, which is the guy who built his own PC for gaming. Obviously I had to bring in some expertise. This is not my core competency. This place has Radio Shack vibes. It's just incredible. Like, I had forgotten what it was like to go buy stuff in a store, like a lot of stuff that's like very, very specific specialty items. But my reason I want to talk about it for the Watchu is because it was really a cool reminder of like the pockets of knowledge that people have that let them get exactly what they want. Like, it was a triumph of capitalism. We walked around this place. We plucked little bits and pieces off the shelves. Obviously, because my son is 10 or almost 10, the thing that he was most focused on was that he wanted the case to be clear glass and that the fans should have LEDs in them. And you know what? No problem. All of that joy was his for like astonishingly little money.
Do the lights change color?
Yeah.
Do they change color in reaction to the game?
Yeah.
Like what's happening?
Absolutely they do. You know, this is like, it's easy to imagine a world where for reasons of Bernie Sanders-ishness or for reasons of kind of safetyism or all kinds of other reasons that our computers would be closed boxes that we can't touch the insides of. Instead, this is something that people can build exactly what they want to do exactly what they want with it. But also, if you are, say, me and you don't want to do that, you can buy a beautiful little closed box that Steve Jobs made for you, and that works out too. So, Micro Center, go in and soak up the consumerist capitalism and personal choice in its best possible forms. Also, every single pair of people in there was a dude wearing some kind of Marvel logo and his goth girlfriend, and I loved it.
This just reminded me of one of the greatest stores, and I think it's now closed, sadly. It's a bygone era, but right near the Burbank Airport, I think it was the original Fry's, or one of the original Fry's electronics, all like the dudes working on Skunk Works nearby, and hobbyists and gadget people, and is gigantic. And also, it was festooned with an entryway design of a gigantic UFO crashing into the head of the building. And then inside, there were many scenes of the aliens coming in and toppling the U.S. military. Just like the single greatest place. I went in there with friends who have goth girlfriends so that they could build me computers about 5 trillion times. And I missed that. And I'm glad to hear that there's other places like that. Nick, what did you consume?
I watched the documentary Radical Wolf, which is directed by Richard Dewey and based on a Vanity Fair article by Michael Lewis, who is the main talking head. It's about Tom Wolfe, the journalist and novelist who, by I think many measures, certainly mine, is the most kind of influential writer journalist over the past 60 years or so, in a series of works including the orange colored or tangerine colored candy flake dream and the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test and The Right Stuff, novels like Bonfire of the Vanities and A Man in Full, changed the way that journalists think about journalism and novelists think about writing novels and things like that. It's a really fantastic, interesting documentary about a very influential character, because Wolf, along with his fellow new journalists, and he's the main kind of theoretician of that phrase in a collection that came out in the early 70s that he co-edited, along with people like Gay Talese and Joan Didion, and to a certain degree, Hunter Thompson, although I think there's a significant difference between the Wolfian new journalists and Thompson. But he really focused on, what might be called the weirdening of America. In post-war America, people got richer and they got ballsier and they decided they weren't going to play by other people's rules. And that is the world we still live in. His most important piece, I think, is The Third Great Awakening, or the Me Decade, which gave the 70s its name. And I think everything leads up to and away from that. But Radical Wolf is a really good documentary that will get people who don't know that much about Wolf, they'll get a good introduction. And for people who already know about Wolf, I think it will reawaken in you a lot of reasons to go back to his work and figure out why he locked into various themes that were really important. And the final takeaway, Matt, and this is where I think he differs from somebody like Hunter S. Thompson, Wolf was first and foremost a reporter and a researcher. And as long as he was describing things that were actually happening, his writing took a back seat. He's an incredible prose stylist, but when you go back to him, much less flashy and kind of offbeat than you think. Somebody like Hunter Thompson, who I know you're a big fan of, I think fell prey to the idea that he was the story and that his stylistic pyrotechnics could overwhelm mediocre material. But it's like over-seasoning a bad cut of meat. And Radical Wolf, I highly recommend it.
Yeah, Thompson, even for people who are enthralled to his cults, the period of useful, great writing and reporting is just one, third of that of Tom Wolfe's career, maybe one quarter of that. Like, 15 years is a great run for everybody, but Wolfe's run was way, way, way longer than all of that. Peter, what did you watch?
I watched Star Wars Ahsoka, which is currently in the middle of its run on Disney Plus. It's good. It has surprisingly strong effects and design work, as well as some of the sort of epic moments that recent Star Wars movies have been missing. It also has a somewhat novel take on the idea of the Force, in that it is very much about moving beyond the light-dark binary that George Lucas initially set up. And it's this idea that there might be a third way, a middle ground, something other than the two sides that are forced upon upon you, and that you, in fact, as an individual, should choose your own way. If I have a real qualm with it, it's that it's very wrapped up in the storylines that began in Dave Filoni's Star Wars cartoons, The Clone Wars and Rebels. So if you're not familiar with those, you may be a little bit lost in this show. But if you are a Star Wars fan and you know the background material, it is fun and it's epic, and it actually delivers on the awe that Star Wars often promises but doesn't quite give you these days, at least in the Disney era.
So my watch you is as follows. If you are a casual listener to Americana music, roots, rock, certain types of country, you have no doubt heard the name Townes Van Zandt over the years, singer, songwriter, tragic case, substance abuser, and the type of person whose late 60s and early 70s songwriting. He wrote Poncho and Lefty, to cut it short. But it's possible as a casual listener to think, oh, well, he was just, because I obviously haven't heard any of his songs with his own throat and guitar playing, he must have been some kind of like Kris Kristofferson, like someone who can't really sing. And that's why you only know people like Steve Earle and Emmylou Harris who cover his songs. That's a mistake. If that is you, if that describes you, because it described me until a couple of weeks ago when I started following various tributaries of the kind of growth and the birth of Americana and outlaw country and other kind of stuff that was happening in the 60s and 70s. Townes Van Zandt's early records, which are basically all he was productive before he completely fell apart. He's this sort of beautiful, very kind of big, lonesome voice, Hank Williams, Graham Parsons-esque, and a marvelous finger picker guitar player. The record that I would recommend people maybe start with for their explorations is the 1969 thing, Our Mother the Mountain. Go on Spotify or whatever, just buy it. It's really good. It's sad and like heart-wrenching and his voice all shaky, but just gorgeous, gorgeous music, and you could see where this comes from. And yeah, he's not just a guy who like couldn't make it because he didn't have the looks or the voice or the chops. He had all of them. So to sabotage it like he did took a lot of heavy lifting. And sadly, he did that too. But yeah, Townes Van Zandt, Our Mother the Mountain, terrific record, and terrific, terrific singer. Really, really great. All right, that's all the singing we have time for on this here podcast. Go to all of our business at audio business, I should say, at reason.com/podcast. Nick, I know we have a lot of events coming up in New York. Are there any that people can still attain ticketing to? That's a word.
Yeah, there is a debate for Open to Debate that I'm moderating on Wednesday night. If you go to Open to Debate at Eventbrite, you will be able to buy tickets. It's about whether or not wokeness is killing comedy, and it features Michael Ian Black as well as Lou Perez. It will come out too late to talk about tonight's Soho Forum debate, so I won't mention good. That. And then next Tuesday, we've got a Reason Speakeasy in Midtown with Yasha Monk, the Johns Hopkins professor and free speech enthusiast, whose new book is called The Identity Trap, and talks about how identity politics is a dead end for many, many reasons. The best way to learn about this stuff is to go to reason.com and click on the newsletters at the top of the website and then sign up for the NYC newsletter, and you'll get ample warning to get out of town when we are producing more and more interesting and fascinating events.
There you can also find the Reason Roundup, which many, many, many scores of thousands of you already subscribe to. But if you haven't, go check it out and the other stuff that we do too. And if you want to encourage us to do more journalism as well as research and advocacy in a libertarian direction, please go to reason.com/donate and do what it says. All right. Thank you for listening, and we will catch you next week. Goodbye.